Well, tonight we continue our series on church history and looking as well at historical theology in the midst of it. And we're using Nick Needham's 2,000 Years of Christ's Power, his volumes on church history, as the primary source for the study. We're in this period now in the 4th century, so in the 300s AD. And Nick Needham titles this section, Christianity, Paganism, and Society in the 4th century AD. We looked at church and state under Constantine. So let's begin. Look in your Bibles at Matthew chapter 22. Matthew chapter 22, and I want to read 15 through 22. Matthew chapter 22, verses 15 to 22. Hear now the words of God. Then the Pharisees went and plotted how they might entangle him, that is Jesus, in his talk. And they sent to him their disciples with the Herodians, saying, Teacher, we know that you are true and teach the way of God in truth. Nor do you care about anyone, for you do not regard the person of men. So they begin with flattery. They're both enemies of Jesus here, the Pharisees who sent the disciples with the Herodians. Pharisees were anti-Roman Empire. The Herodians were pro-Roman Empire. But both the Herodians and the Pharisees usually were at each other's throats because they had different stances with the Roman Empire. But here they united it, trying to trick Jesus. And they begin with flattery. Verse 17, Tell us, therefore, what do you think? Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? But Jesus perceived their wickedness and said, Why do you test me, you hypocrites? Show me the tax money. So they brought him a denarius. And he said to them, Whose image and inscription is this? They said to him, Caesar's. And he said to them, Render therefore to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. When they had heard these words, they marveled and left him and went their way. Now they thought they had him in a catch-22. An either-or situation. Either he would say, pay taxes to Rome, and he would make the Israelites mad. Most of his multitudes that followed him, who didn't like the Roman Empire. Or he would say, do not pay taxes to Caesar. And then they would turn him in as a traitor to Rome. They had him either way. As a catch-22. Either way, he'd be doomed. Well, it's referred to as an either-or fallacy. An either-or fallacy where it's presented as if you only have two options. But there was a third option. And the third option involves separation of church and state under God. Rendering unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's and unto God the things that are God's. Two different institutions under God's authority. And we're in the middle of this section in church history where Christianity just begins to be officially recognized as a religion rather than persecuted under Constantine. Remember at the Battle of the Milvian Bridge the night before, he had a dream, a vision. And it was the Chiros sign, first two letters of Christ's name in Greek, and the X and the P, but the X is at an angle, and with the P it formed a cross. And the next morning he had that in all his shields, because he had heard or seen in the dream, by this sign you will conquer, by the sign of the cross. And he put it on the shields of his troops, and he won against Maxentius. He had been a sun worshiper. He'd been an idol worshiper of the sun that rises sets each day. And after that point, then he was converted to Christianity. And he had signed, you remember, after that he had signed an agreement with Licinius, the emperor of the East, the eastern part of the Roman Empire, to allow religious freedom for both pagans and Christians. Licinius in the East was a pagan. Well, after a few years, you remember that Licinius began to persecute Christians severely in the East. And that's where Constantine believed he had sanction from God Almighty, the living and true God, to have a holy war against Licinius, and he took him on and won. And at age 32, became the emperor of the entire Roman Empire. And he did many things. You remember he had a Spanish bishop, a Christian bishop in Spain that was his advisor. You remember that he made Sundays, which is the Christian official weekly day of worship. He made Sundays an official day of rest in the Roman Empire. You remember he outlawed crucifixion as punishment. You remember he outlawed branding of criminals on their foreheads, saying that human faces are meant to reflect the dignity of God and should not be branded on the forehead. You remember he had maintenance grants for the poor, trying to prevent killing of unwanted children. He tried to outlaw the gladiators as too violent as a sport. So he was trying from the moral side to implement Christian morals, Christian ethics, in neighborly relations and punishments, protecting certain human rights. Well, you remember when we looked at Constantine in two areas, with the Donatists and with the Arians, he intruded into the church, into the administration and theology of the church. So in this balance of church and state, both under God, it's this tension and balance to say, okay, where is the line drawn where they shouldn't go into each other's affairs? And we've seen under Constantine with the Donatist controversy, you remember in Northwest Africa, when one of the bishops was confirmed, the group of bishops had one that had given a Bible over to be burned under the persecution of Diocletian. So therefore the Donatists were purists and said, we don't think that's legitimate, that that bishop was appointed in a legitimate way, because one of the people that appointed him was one who had turned the Bible over to be burned under Diocletian, under the persecution. He had lapsed. And therefore we think, therefore, that it's illegitimate. So there was this battle. Since Constantine ordered the property that had been confiscated under Diocletian to be returned to the church, the question, though, is which church do you return it to? Of the Donatists or of the one that the other bishops of the Catholic Church appointed as bishop? And he let the bishops decide in their tribunal, and he enforced their decision to not give it to the Donatists, and he confiscated the Donatist property and exiled them, trying to get them to conform. That was the first time state power was used against nonconformists. So Christians who would not conform, trying to bring them back into the Catholic Church, and he used state power to try and do it. Remember, he admitted it failed, so then he annulled his edict. Remember, though, against the Arians that those were heretics that said Jesus was just created, not a divine being. Followers of Arius. And it was Constantine who, with the great Nicene Council that was put together that formed the Nicene Creed in 325 AD, it was Constantine who called it together. He's the one that instigated the Nicene Council. It didn't come from the bishops. It came from Constantine, the emperor. And he's the one that picked the bishops. He was involved in selecting the bishops who would be a part of that, which obviously affects the result of the Nicene Creed. So he was intermingling then in the administration and theology of the church, even though you could say it was in a good way with the results of the Nicene Creed. Well, what we're going to see later this evening is with Ambrose on the other side of the coin, where the church can also use its power over an emperor and, in a sense, control the emperor with Ambrose of Milan. another bishop. Okay? So this is this balance of church and state that we're seeing then beginning to play out once the church gets officially recognized as a religion and no longer persecuted. And at the time of Constantine, remember, most of the citizens of the Roman Empire were pagans yet. Okay? But it's going to be moving then with Constantine's sons here. This is under number two in this section, Christians, Pagans, and the State. Constantius is one of Constantine's sons, sometimes referred to as Constantius II. But from Constantius to Theodosius, okay, in the 4th century, in the 300s AD. And Constantine's sons then will move the empire from paganism more towards Christianity, and it won't become then the official religion of the Roman Empire until Theodosius, toward the end of the 300s AD. But it's how Ambrose then is going to be doing some controlling of Theodosius. We're going to see the church intrude upon the state. Okay, so they both can go both ways, is the point of this early history, where Christianity is just becoming to be recognized then to an official religion, but you're still battling it out between what is this balance between church and state, both under God. And we see struggles at the very beginning. Okay. So one of his sons, Emperor Constantius, he ruled the East in 337 AD to 353 AD, and the West as well from 353 to 361 AD, over the whole thing, East and West. He was more aggressive against paganism. This is where they began to try and move the empire more and more toward Christianity. In 356 AD, Constantius, as emperor, forbade all animal sacrifices of the pagans and ordered all pagan temples closed across the empire. At this point, many joined the Christian church because it became fashionable across the empire. So you're not really allowing then full free exercise of religion, closing the pagan temples. And many then joined because it was fashionable. Well, they closed the pagan temples, let's join Christianity and give it a try. But of the aristocratic, the wealthy families in Rome, many of the Roman aristocratic families in the West remained fairly committed to paganism, even though Constantius closed the pagan temples. They're very nostalgic to the founding of Rome. It began with paganism. You know, by this point, Rome's been around for over 1,000 years. Its founding again, you remember, by legend in 753 BC. But it had a pagan beginning and was pagan all the way through for over 1,000 years. Now, this drift towards Christianity from Constantine's sons suddenly was reversed in 361 AD by the Emperor Julian. The Emperor Julian was brought up as a Christian. In fact, he maintained the formal religion of Christianity really until he became supreme, the emperor. And then he let his real heart show. He did not believe Christianity was the true religion. He had rejected it as a young man in favor of Neoplatonism. And that's why he's referred to as Julian the Apostate. And he did many things to try and bring the Empire of Rome back to paganism. He restricted government jobs to pagans. Christians can't serve in the government. He abolished Sunday as a special day of rest in the empire, to have it treated just like any other day. He required all educational entities to teach paganism, He wrote an anti-Christian book titled Against the Galileans. And he built new pagan temples, reintroduced the pagan animal sacrifices, and tried to institute a new form of a pagan church to rival the Catholic Church. Now, his reforms did not last long in God's providence. God cut his reforms short, for he died in battle, fighting the Persians in 363 AD. 2 years he was emperor, instituting all these reforms, trying to bring the empire back to paganism, and frowning providence took his life. Now we had providence, remember, with Constantine and the vision he saw. God's smiling providence. And with a smaller army, Constantine won at the Battle of Milvian Bridge against Maxentius. God's smiling providence. Frowning providence against Julian, but smiling providence for the Roman Empire and Christians. Tradition says that his dying words, Julian the Apostate's dying words, speaking to Christ, he said, "You have conquered, O Galilean." Jesus was of Galilee, at the center of his ministry. "You have conquered, O Galilean." Now, Julian the Apostate was the last Roman emperor. The last Roman emperor to not profess the Christian faith. So what was so historic about it? In the Roman Empire, that was the last Roman emperor not to profess the Christian faith. Now, before I continue with the story and history, I just want to say, what's so fascinating about Julian the Apostate for our day and age? For those that have been following along in my America and Western Civilization class, you'll remember a man named Carl Jung. Carl Jung. He was one of the founders of modern psychology. He was born in 1875. Sigmund Freud was the other founder of modern psychology. Sigmund Freud was an atheist. But Carl Jung was a pagan. Carl Jung was an expert on ancient paganism, the Greco-Roman world, and ancient Gnosticism, and occultism, and Far Eastern religions. Not many biographies have been written on him. Peter Jones came across this. This, I believe, was a Harvard researcher, Richard Knoll. He wrote a biography of Carl Jung, the Aryan Christ. Carl Jung is the one who his views, not the atheism views of Sigmund Freud, but the pagan views of Carl Jung, is what won the day in our culture, the 1960s Cultural Revolution. And this is what the biographer of Carl Jung says. He says, "I have come to the conclusion that as an individual, Carl Jung ranks with the Roman Emperor Julian the Apostate as one who significantly undermined Orthodox Christianity and restored the polytheism of the Hellenistic world and Western civilization." In other words, where Julian the Apostate failed, he failed because he died after being only 2 years as emperor. He failed to bring the Roman Empire back to paganism. But where Julian the Apostate failed, Carl Jung succeeded. And the dominant culture of our day and age is a new form of paganism, neo-paganism, from the 1960s Cultural Revolution. And you can see, when you think about how they tried to restrict who teaches at our colleges and universities, what they teach in our curriculum. Right? He wanted to have all the educational institutions teach paganism, where today they have this crazy transgenderism and wokeism and multiculturalism and all of these new forms of paganism with Mother Earth and environmentalism in our curriculum, in our schools. Christians can hardly get a teaching job at a government university or college right now. Sundays, every day is alike right now because of the 1960s Cultural Revolution. Used to be in America, Sundays were an official day of rest. Not that everyone was a Christian and not that everyone worshipped at a Christian church, but it was an official day of rest. We had Sunday blue laws, because there was typically written the laws on blue paper. That is the official day of rest each week. Only essential businesses were allowed open. So, by the grace of God, at that time, Julian the Apostate's life was cut short. And his reforms didn't hold. Otherwise, who knows what would have happened in history. By 380 AD, Theodosius I, who was emperor 379 to 395 AD, and he was emperor of the East, and he issued an edict announcing his intent for all in his domain to accept Christianity. That was his intent. Now, you remember the first nation to make Christianity its official religion, we covered it, was through the missionary work of Gregory the Illuminator. In 300 AD, the nation of Armenia, east of Turkey, east of the Roman Empire at that time, became the first kingdom to officially recognize Christianity as its official religion in 300 AD. Through the missionary work, through the king of Armenia and his family, through Gregory the Illuminator. Well, here, almost 100 years later, we have in the Roman Empire, Theodosius I issuing the edict in the East, announcing his intent for all in his domain to accept Christianity. And he ruled the whole empire from 392 to 395 AD at the very end of his term as emperor. He's referred to as Theodosius the Great. He ordered all pagan temples closed again. So they'd been closed by Constantius and then reopened under Julian the Apostate, and now they're closed again. And sacrifices again became illegal. Orthodox Christianity was to be the official religion of the empire. And this is where then it went from toleration to free exercise of Christianity to now being the official religion of the empire. Though pagan worship continued openly in some places, it's a big empire, so in some local areas it still was occurring, pagan worship services, but certainly it continued in secret. Pagan worship continued in secret for a long time. But paganism was finished in the Roman Empire as any form of a public faith, in public. It was finished. Its days were done. What's fascinating to me is the instrumentality of civil government rulers to bring it about in God's providence. Through the conversion of Constantine and through his sons, and then through Theodosius. The only non-Christian group the Roman Empire officially tolerated was the Jews. It's kind of interesting. To say not approved, that toleration is not approval, but we'll tolerate it. We won't persecute it. Some emperors in this period were Arians. So even though you had the Nicene Council and the Nicene Creed, 325 AD, which repudiated Arianism, some emperors during this period of time, toward the end of the 300s AD, 4th century AD, were Arians and used their state power to advance the Arian heresy and persecute Christians. Athanasius, He lived roughly 296 AD to 373 AD. He was Bishop of Alexandria. He regarded the Arian Emperor Constantius as an antichrist, saying emperors should have no authority over internal church matters. In 355 AD, Constantius had ordered Bishop Hosius of Cordova to accept Arians at the Lord's table at communion. Hosius replied, this bishop replied, that the emperor should not be involved in the affairs of the church. And he referenced Matthew 22, verse 21. Give unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and unto God's the things that are God's. If the empire and the church each have their own particular authority marked out for them by God, and an emperor should not order the church who or who not they should have at communion. But this is this battle then that begins to play out. And it'll play out all the way through history, all the way to America. And in a certain sense, it's still being debated right now as we stand here. So the empire, the idea from the bishop's side is the empire rules in all earthly, civil, political matters according to God's law that applies to those areas. So in neighborly relations. And then the church rules itself in all matters of evangelical doctrine and discipline. So that's the response of the Bishop Hosius of Cordova to Constantius. The idea of separation of church and state, both under God, but each having their own jurisdiction. Jurisdiction literally means jurisdiction, law to speak, literally. To speak the law, the authority to speak the law. And you say, well, what law? Well, they're given different laws for their different institutions and responsibilities. Where the church has been given God's laws and directions for evangelical doctrine and church discipline, administering things in the church. But the empire, the civil government, the state, should be all over earthly, civil, political matters, according to God's law. So in the Roman Empire, there's kind of been this division from the beginning of church history from the first century on, where you remember the East is more Greek, more Hellenistic, the West is more Latin speaking. And there was an imaginary line between Greece and Italy. That's where that line was. The west of there, Italy and Western Europe and Western North Africa is more the west part of the empire, and then Greece and East is the eastern part of the empire. Well, the west part of the Roman Empire absorbed much of this thinking of separation of church and state, having different jurisdictions and responsibilities, but the East accepted the emperor's authority in church affairs. And as we'll see play out, as we've mentioned already, is when the Western Empire falls to the Germanic tribes of Europe in 410 AD, the East is known as the Byzantine Empire at that point on. So it's the Byzantine Empire is in the East is the one that accepts more of the emperor's authority in church affairs. But it was the West that did not. America is a descendant of the West. Okay? That's where you think Great Britain. That was a part of the Western Empire. Remember, Constantine's father had his base there as one of the emperors in the West, then Great Britain. But that's more our history of trying this battle of saying there's two institutions, church and state, and they have two different responsibilities under God, some form of separation. But the East was more Hellenistic. The East was more Greek, eastern side of the empire, so they tended to see kings and rulers more as divine figures or representative of God. So therefore, more as one who would be the head of the church and the state, both, having more of a Greek history. Well, the Western doctrine of the independence of the church came in its clearest expression with Ambrose of Milan. Ambrose of Milan, 339 to 397 AD, is Ambrose. So he's a contemporary of Athanasius of Alexandria. It's interesting, Ambrose's background. Ambrose was a Catholic provincial governor. A Catholic provincial governor. So the Roman Empire was in different provinces, right? And that governors governed different provinces. And that's what he was in 374 AD when he became bishop of Milan. Before, he'd been a governor, a civil government leader. What's unique about the city of Milan? Well, after the city of Rome, the city of Milan really was the most important city of Italy. Remember, that's where Constantine met with Licinius in the east to have their edict together, their agreement for religious freedom for both Christians and pagans, was in Milan. So the city of Milan had a very important place in the Roman Empire and really was the most important city after the city of Rome. Well, in 374 AD, Ambrose was the Catholic provincial governor, and the bishop at the time was Auxentius, and he was the leading Arian in the West. The leading Arian in the West, and he died that year in 374 AD. And he was the bishop of Milan. The leading Arian in the West had been the bishop of Milan. He dies 374 AD. As governor of the province, Ambrose, his main responsibility is to keep the peace, law and order. He's worried about a civil war between Christians and Arians. Who's going to replace here Auxentius, the leading Arian that just died, who had been the bishop of Milan? Who's going to replace him? And he's speaking to the crowd, trying to calm them. He doesn't want the fight as to who's going to become the next bishop to turn into a civil war. So he's speaking before a crowd, trying to calm them. And the sound of a child yelling out, saying, "Ambrose for bishop," in the midst of the crowd. "Ambrose for bishop." He's been the governor. And the whole crowd then starts chanting, "Ambrose for bishop." Now, he was not a presbyter or elder even in the Catholic Church. Now, again, if we were in that time, we'd be a member of the Catholic Church. That was the Orthodox Church. He was not even an elder or presbyter. He was not in church leadership. He was only a catechumen. He was not even yet baptized. He was just going through the catechizing process. This could take a couple of years. At first, he was horrified. "Me? Bishop? No way." But he reluctantly accepted seeing the event as God's will, starting with some child hollering it out and the whole crowd. I guess it's God's will. I'll do it. So, in 374 AD, he becomes the Bishop of Milan, in the second most important city of Italy at that time, next to Rome. He made fame as a magnificent preacher. He was a firm enemy of Arianism, so he defended the deity of Christ. Christ is truly God, the eternal, only begotten Son of God. Truly God, truly man, two natures in one person. He was a firm enemy of Arianism, and he was a creative hymn writer, which is very unique at that point in history. We've covered a little bit with the way church services worked, you remember, in the 100s AD, in the 2nd century AD. Well, the psalms were chanted, or they were sung responsively. The Psalms from the Bible, the Old Testament. He introduced what's called antiphonal singing. Antiphonal singing. And Pastor Ron's done this before, particularly on Sunday evenings. where half sings one part, and then a half sings another part. Sometimes Pastor Ron had the men sing one part and the women sing another part. Or the young sing one part and then the older people sing one part. But antiphonal singing he introduced from Milan, and then from there it spread to all the churches in the West. Some a new form of worshiping God in song. He also popularized in the West the Eastern practice of singing hymns, rather than just staying to the Psalter, to the Psalms. He introduced in the West the Eastern practice of singing hymns. Hymns are newly written songs of worship. Newly written songs of worship. What's interesting is Ambrose wrote his own hymns to teach his congregation the orthodox doctrine of Christ during the Arian controversy. He wrote his own hymns to teach his congregation about the deity of Jesus Christ against the heresy and falsehoods of Arianism. And that's where, you know, Pastor Ron has stressed many times, we learn a lot of great theology from hymns. A lot of teaching is done that way. And it seems the theology a lot of the Corinth have brought has been from their hymns, the few that they do sing. When the emperor Theodosius the Great made Milan his western capital, Ambrose became his close friend and advisor. This is where we're going to get some unique things here with the relationship of church and state. Ambrose said at the time, he said, quote, "The church belongs to God, and therefore it cannot be assigned to Caesar. The emperor is within the church, not above it." Unquote. Say it again. "The church belongs to God, therefore it cannot be assigned to Caesar. The emperor is within the church, not above it." Again, this is what's unique in the West, different than the East. In 390 AD, there was a famous confrontation between Ambrose as bishop and Theodosius as emperor. In 390 AD, what happened? Well, a rioting mob in Thessalonica, remember in Macedonian area, kind of northeast of Greece, in very southeast Europe, a rioting mob in Thessalonica murdered the governor of the province. And Theodosius, the emperor, was in a fit of rage and anger. And he immediately ordered the Roman army to massacre the Thessalonians. But almost immediately he changed his mind. He didn't want them to massacre the Thessalonians after a change of mind, but it was too late. His order had already gone out, and the Roman soldiers were ready for revenge. And the Roman soldiers butchered some 7,000 people at Thessalonica. In response, Bishop Ambrose excommunicated Theodosius. Excommunicated him, saying, "You're barred from partaking of communion. We'll treat you like an unbeliever." And Ambrose demanded deep, serious repentance. Interestingly, Theodosius, the emperor, showed up at church like nothing had happened. Ambrose barred his entry into church, even though the emperor claimed he had repented. Ambrose said that such a public sin demanded public penance. And in this case, it ended up being 8 months of public penance. And the emperor walked the streets of Milan in public penance for 8 months. After 8 months, upon entry to the church, Ambrose demanded that the emperor Theodosius kneel in the church publicly and beg God's forgiveness for his sin. of having the Roman troops massacre the Thessalonians. Emperor Theodosius did what Ambrose asked him to do. He kneeled, he begged for forgiveness with tears streaming down his face. What's so significant about all this? This is the first time that a Christian bishop used his spiritual authority to humble an emperor. It's the first time that a Christian bishop used his spiritual authority in the church to humble an emperor. Now, Nick Needham points out that the personality of Ambrose probably had something to do with it. He had been a governor. Afterwards, Theodosius would repeatedly say, quote, "The only real bishop I know is Ambrose. The only real bishop I know is Ambrose." He had great respect for Ambrose and his authority in the church. But here's where you see the church can begin exerting and controlling an emperor who's a Christian inside the church. Controlling the emperor through discipline. So the West's doctrine of the church's independence could, in practice, turn into the church controlling the emperor. Where we've seen with Constantine, the emperor had great influence on the church in the Donatus controversy as well as the Nicene Council and Creed. Where here, with Ambrose as bishop, he could begin controlling the emperor, the state. Now, just before the Thessalonian massacre, it was in 390 AD, in 388 AD, the Christians of Callinicium on the Euphrates River in present-day Iraq, they burnt down a Jewish synagogue. Christians burnt down a Jewish synagogue. Theodosius the emperor, ordered the local bishop of that area to rebuild the synagogue with church funds. Say, Christians burnt down the Jewish synagogue. Well, the Roman emperor, Theodosius the Great, ordered the local bishop to use church funds and say, you rebuild that Jewish synagogue. Ambrose, the bishop of Milan, believed it was wrong to use church funds to build a place for non-Christians to worship. The Jews did not believe Jesus was the Christ. So the Jews were not saved. Ambrose believed it was wrong to use church funds to build a place for non-Christians to worship. Ambrose preached a sermon against Theodosius, who was in the church, sitting with everyone else in the church. Ambrose preached a sermon against Theodosius while in the congregation and refused to let the emperor partake of communion until he gave up his plan, which Theodosius eventually did. Theodosius gave up his plan to force the church to use church funds to rebuild the Jewish synagogue, a non-Christian place of worship. Theodosius gave in to Ambrose, and the Jewish synagogue was not rebuilt. Another instance where you have Bishop Ambrose, the church, controlling the emperor through church discipline. So, a church leader could use his disciplinary power to force a Christian emperor into obeying his will. This is where it can go both ways. Where the church can try and control the emperor, or the emperor can try and control the church. In church-state relations, either side can abuse its power. That's the lesson we learn in this period of time. In church-state relations, either side can abuse its power. whether it was Constantine against the Donatists, the nonconformists, or whether it's Ambrose here against Theodosius, the emperor. So it's an intricate balance where you draw that line. But remember, the general outline is there here at the beginning, where the empire in the West, the idea in the general setting, in the general frame of the biblical mandate, is the empire rules all earthly civil political matters according to God's law that applies to those areas, but the church rules itself in all matters of evangelical doctrine and church discipline and administration. But you get into a unique situation is, well, what if the emperor is a member of the church and a Christian, and the bishop overseeing the church doesn't like what the emperor has done and excommunicates him? He says, you're not coming back in unless you do steep penance and do what I want. So that's where it can go both ways. So the next time we meet, Lord willing, we're going to look at the development of church teaching, organization, worship, and life during this period of time in the 4th century AD.